Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Direct Instruction Podcast, sponsored by the National Institute for Direct Instruction. My name is Zach Rochelle, and I'm your host. I am so excited today to be talking to Owen Engelman all about the field testing process that has to occur during the initial production and revision of direct instruction programs. I myself have been told by many people that all programs essentially are field tested and that they're all field tested just as rigorously. And we often throw that word around, field testing, without any sort of criteria. And I think the public needs to know what it really takes to field test something rigorously in a way that looks at student performance in particular. So I had to bring the world's expert on this very topic, Owen Engelman, onto the show so he can talk to us about this very important topic. Owen, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. I'm really excited to be here. Thank you very much.
And it's great because people coming onto this podcast probably know this is a big DI podcast in the Engelman tradition, and you carry that name. So I'm curious, maybe you introduce yourself and tell us like a little bit about yourself before we get started.
Oh, well, that's my favorite subject, talking about me. I've been involved in direct instruction. I started working summers when I was in high school, writing items and doing things while they were developing actually the corrective reading program. I vowed I'd never get involved in education because I saw the trials and tribulations that my dad had to go through, and I ended up doing it for a career. So I was a project director for NIFTY, an implementation director for NIFTY, and then I was the director of curricular resources. And at the same time, I was working with my dad, revising and creating new programs. So I've been doing this now for 45 years. And, fortunately, I think in some respects, I'm pretty good at it.
One question that people often ask me is like, who makes DI? Because there's like three different kind of arms to all of this, and it maybe is confusing to someone who's initially getting into the world of DI. Like, is this McGraw-Hill? What's NIFTY? And then there's a third one that I think is probably not as mentioned as much, but that has a huge role in all of this, and that's Engelman Becker. Maybe you could explain to us like how that works.
Well, my dad, during the follow-through days, the evolution of developing these programs, for a lot of reasons, they needed to create a separate entity that did it. Fundamentally, the federal government wanted to take control of the program because, hey, you were doing it on federal money, so we own it. And so they created the Engelman Becker Corporation to be the development house for the direct instruction co-authors. And yes, we develop the instructional materials, and that involves working with schools and field testing programs and doing a lot of the analysis and developing tools to, you know, advance the analysis of what we need to do to create these programs that will consistently work and will consistently teach everything that the program, you know, claims to deliver in that subject matter. And that's the primary reason that Engelman Becker exists, is to, help educate people about what we're doing with direct instruction, but also create these programs that are going to be consistently successful.
Awesome. And part of that sort of design and development sort of cycle and process is field testing. So I wanted to pick your brain on this. I saw Kurt actually post something that you wrote about field testing, and it made me think this is something that schools need to understand. You're part of a adoption committee, you're maybe at a school board and you're looking at different programs, and number one, I think Gene Stockard addressed this in another episode, everything is evidence-based. And the second one is that everything is field tested. So tell me, first of all, just sort of orient us a little bit, what are the goals of field testing and of doing that field testing process?
Well, I agree and I laugh because the goal is where it comes out. So the main point, the overarching point of field testing is to achieve the DI standard of 100% of the students at 95% mastery of the subject matter being taught, if they're taught according to adequate parameters of implementing the direct instruction program. I mean, that's the overreaching goal. We are finishing and putting finishing touches on a revision of the corrective reading program, which has been scientifically validated and very successful for 50 years. But this revision had some additional goals. Of course, there's market concerns. Over 50 years, guess what? A lot of the information about science has changed. A lot of the social interactions that are expected to be seen have changed. And most of those were not changed over, since the 70s. So we had to address those. But the most important one is being able to help the students become proficient. And with corrective readers, it's very interesting because you've got an added layer of stuff to work through, because corrective readers, by their very definition, have learned to do things, reading, poorly. We need to replace those habits. And through effective instruction and through crafting comprehension questions and tasks in a way, we can really help mitigate, corrective readers have two main issues. They are often limited in terms of their fluency and prosody because they don't understand what they're reading. Not only are they inaccurate, they don't understand it. So in addition to improving their accuracy so they're getting the information off the paper, hearing the words off the paper, we also want to give them a sufficient amount of understanding so they can become, more fluent, be able to read with appropriate prosody. The other issue that corrective readers tend to have is because they have consistently had failed in a lot of areas, they have learned that academic tasks are mysterious and they required head scratching and strategies that don't tend to be reliable. We need to replace that and replace that orientation with them being engaged with and understanding that academics can be very straightforward and they can be very successful at them. And that obviously in turn also improves their self-image. So these are other goals for, specifically for the corrective reader that we had to incorporate in what we want to do with our field testing of the programs.
Awesome. And so walk me through what this actually looks like. Who does it? Where are you at? What gets recorded? Like, I can picture any number of things. I can picture a very messy kind of, regular classroom that might be, however, ecologically valid. I can imagine it in a lab or in your offices. So how does this exactly work?
I think that's a great question because we can grab almost any car and get 100 miles a gallon out of it if it's on a windless track with a conveyor belt, right? But we want to get information from what the teacher will experience in the classroom. So it's got to be real classroom, complete instruction. Since we are creating these programs to achieve these goals, we need to know everything that happens with regard to instruction in that subject material. So the current way we gather the data that we use is often audio recorders. All of the teachers that are field testing our programs have an audio recorder. When instruction starts in that subject, they start the audio recorder. Doesn't matter if somebody comes in from the office with a message. It doesn't matter if there's a fire alarm. It doesn't matter if they have to diverge and do some other instruction in that subject material. We want to hear about it because all of that could affect the instruction of, you know, the field test information and data that we're collecting. And we want it to be a slice of life. Of course, there's, you know, requirements that we want to have in a field test to make sure that the program is being judged fairly. Kids are placed appropriately, the schedule is adequate, and, you know, the teacher does as good of a, they try as hard as possible to be able to implement the program with fidelity. So those are requirements that we have, but then we get the audio recordings of all the instruction, and they send us all of the written work so we can analyze that as well to look, you know, basically what we look for when we get all that material is problems. Because if at the end of the program, the kids are performing perfectly or really well at 95%, then we know that they're, you know, the program is successful. But let me tell you something, that never happens on the first, second, or even third crack at it.
Well, I do have a few questions there that just kind of come up. It's like you said, like the teacher needs to, you know, try their best to follow the program as it's written and as is intended, which would make a lot of sense. And since DI is a scripted program, it's sort of baked into it, of course, right? But it would seem like it would make sense to choose teachers who know how to deliver, like have some level of experience, you know, like if you just picked a teacher right up out of university and said, hey, here's the thing. I mean, they might not even have ever read a script. So how do you find that sweet spot between like who you choose and who you elect to involve in this so you can get the data you're looking for?
Like the kids in the groups, we like a range, and we also like a range of teachers. We have learned, and we have been so fortunate to have as our professional development director, Lynn House, who's a former project director with NIFTY, and she is a marvelous teacher and a very, very good trainer. You know, she's working and usually has weekly meetings and training sessions with teachers. And I am doing training sessions with quotes because some of the teachers don't need it, but some of the teachers that end up being field test teachers need it a lot. Now, most of the time, we want to look for a teacher who's at least adequate. You know, they might be relatively new to DI, but they understand that they need to follow the script and do things. We've had several experiences where our teachers, well, like, for instance, one of the teachers we were working with on the corrective reading, when we were first listening to the recordings, there would be kids would make a mistake and you would hear scribbling for 2 minutes, and then she just proceed. And it's like, what is going on? No corrections, none of this other stuff. And Lynn House had a meeting with her, and she's like, oh, and what's going on there? Well, I'm making notes about what the errors are so I can follow up on it. And then she walked and started working with the teacher on what normal DI correction procedures were. That's an extreme example, but we have to deal with this. And so Lynn House is there to ensure that the presentation is adequate. We, you know, we often do have at least one star teacher who field tests it, but We also know that most of them aren't going to have that level of experience and that level of skill. So we need to make sure that the program's going to work for somebody who has adequate training.
Yeah, and I guess that gets to like the students as well, because DI famously is really concerned about eradicating like the achievement gap. I mean, that was the whole project follow through, the mission. I always say like the original social justice warriors before the words we started using that word. And so there is this focus on low achieving students or students in disadvantaged schools, but also because of the nature of DI and there's placement, there's tons of schools that use DI to accelerate students. How do you deal with that so that you can make sure that the program will work for various communities?
Well, we have learned over 50 years that if you create a program that's going to work with the lowest performers, it will work with all performers. And it's much easier to teach a DI teacher who's adequate how to accelerate students that are doing great. And as a matter of fact, you mentioned that, that DI is used in many places to accelerate students. There's a lot of data that shows that high-performing students benefit as much or more from DI as lower performing students, because it just fills in all of those gaps that often occur in other less efficient instructional programs. So we want a range of students, and we also want a range of teachers. You know, for the corrective reading program, we had several groups of students at City Springs Elementary in Baltimore, which is a low performing school, but they do a really, really good job with those students. We had students that were in very low English areas that had a lot of high Hispanic populations. And then we also had, you know, normal kids in high school, and also in middle school and elementary school that went through the field test process for different levels of the corrective reading.
Totally makes sense. And I think though about DI programs and people, we've got to get your colleague Evan Haney on this podcast to talk about design. We've been wanting to talk about theory of instruction, but nobody seems to want to dive nearly as deep as I want to into it, or there's just a handful of people that know it. You know, if we think about the design of these programs, there's just so many components. I mean, this isn't a DI isn't just the teacher scripts. There's student-facing materials. There are mastery tests. There's the teacher's guide that gives, you know, like you said, like we alluded to earlier, like a skip cycle type of approach or remediation materials. There's all of these different pieces that all need to be perfectly aligned and coordinated. So like when you're doing this field testing, how do you handle all of these things? Like they can come in so many different grain sizes.
What's very interesting is we are using all of the arrows in our DI quiver to initially build a field test version that we're going to try out. Once we start the tryout, the focus changes completely, because now it is only on what we have or do not have in that program and how the teacher is performing and the students are performing and how long it takes. The development goes from, you know, pretty widespread and putting all these little pieces together to now we've got this structure, we've got this building, now we're going to make it so it can deliver the covenant of what we have with our customers, which is all of the kids are going to master all of the material.
So when you design a program for initial field testing, do you deploy the whole puppy, like all 165 to 180 lessons for the program, or do you create something of a template to field test that, and then I'm curious about how that kind of works.
That's great. First of all, complete lessons are all that's field tested. So by the time the field test starts, we usually want to have about 20 or 30 lessons that are ready to go. Why don't we do more lessons? Because something's going to be wrong and we're going to have to change them, and we don't want to have to redo all that work all the time. So, you know, we take it incrementally, and as we get closer to the lessons that we've already done, then we'll produce some more lessons and put together all the pieces that we've already created. So basically, we have a big we have all of the programs scoped out, which is what we need to do, because we have a starting point and an ending point, and our responsibility is to create the lessons to bring the kids from that starting point to that ending point. But we only do about 30 lessons at a time. But when they're being field tested, it is the complete lessons. So, you know, and again, if it's the first iteration of the field test where it's being presented to a group for the first time, if there are significant enough errors or the wrong kind of errors, then clearly we're going to have to field test. We're going to have to fix it and field test that stuff again. Did I answer the question?
Yeah. And it actually really makes sense if you know about the DI design, that it's very rare when you get an exercise that a student will have mastered a very meaty topic or a complex skill. It's always this is what, when new teachers always get confused about, I think, when they first start, at least I did, was you start with this lesson and you go, where's this going? I feel like I taught half of something, right? And then the next day, it all makes sense, right? You're they couldn't have handled doing both things simultaneously. So the 30 lesson thing makes sense, because you can't really deliver a DI lesson at once, because they build and they weave in that track design, I guess.
Absolutely. No, and you know, a specific example of that was in this revision, we saw that there were chronic mistakes in writing words without endings. And in certain kinds of words in the corrective reading C passages. And these mistakes often didn't even bump the kids over the error limit, so they had to reread the whole parts, but they were significant enough of a pattern that we were going, okay, this is a problem, and especially compared to the writing words without endings. And what we realized is the kids were having real issues identifying what the vowel sound was for the doubled or singled consonant in words with endings. So it was the classic. So we realized that we had to implement the vowel sound rule. And when we did that, we saw that we had made mistakes on implementing it, because we didn't teach some of the pre-skills. A lot of those things that you identified that you go, I only taught half of that. You know, what's going on there? The reason is we need to give them a digestible amount. And like you know, in the direct instruction programs, there are going to be 8 different tracks, you know, anywhere from 6 to 8 tracks going at the same time. All of them are teaching little bits of these, you know, pieces of information. And why it's only half that is because we realized that we needed to back off some of these skills that we were teaching in all at once, and we need to give them more practice with the pieces of it before we expected them to integrate those pieces into a higher order concept and apply that concept. And that's basically what happened. So in the vowel sound rule, first of all, we jump to the conclusion that they would be able to immediately know if there were 2 consonants or, you know, more than 1 consonant or 1 consonant. Well, some of the kids, they knew what a consonant was, they knew what vowels were, but being able to do that just off the cuff was something that most of the kids were having trouble with. So then we had to back up instruction and just remind them, hey, you know what the vowels are. What's the first vowel in this word? What's the next vowel in this word? Yes. And do that for a couple of days before we get to now, what's the first vowel? What's the next vowel? What are the consonants between them? How many of them are there? And so we gradually built this rule so they could understand and have a solid strategy for identifying the vowel sound.
It makes a lot of sense, but I have a feeling that this isn't actually how it goes in education and in the development of many different programs, right? But I'm told by many folks, especially if they have a pet program or they use this, right, that there was a rigorously field tested evidence based program. And it's hard to find any documentation on that field testing. It's hard to know if that field testing involved actually more about like usability requirements for the teachers or whatever else, and not focusing on the performance of the students. So you know the field being in this space, like what differentiates or distinguishes the DI field testing process from your typical field testing process you see in other programs?
I really don't have as much experience with other programs as you would think. So I really don't know what their field test process is. However, I think it circles back to what's the goal of the field test. So our goal is very clear. We want to be able to have those kids master all of the subject matter and be ready to be successful in whatever comes next. That's our goal. And, you know, we have this iterative field test process to ensure it. If you examine these other programs, you can conclude one of two things. Either they're very, very bad at field testing to make the program effective, or their field test is nothing about effectiveness, or it has very little to do with effectiveness, or, you know, it might have something to do more with the experience of the kids versus how they're performing at the end and how they feel about themselves. I also want to point out one other thing that, you know, back when my dad was writing the direct instruction programs initially, most of the educational programs were being created by educators who were actually teachers working in the field. There are very, very few programs like that anymore. I mean, they rarely occur. The publisher hires people to create programs based on what they want. I am projecting now, and I don't have evidence, but my suspicion is that since all this field testing is being done by publishers, it's more like they're field testing for appeal and palatability rather than field testing for efficacy.
That makes sense to me. And it feels like, too, because like DI takes a very, very scientific approach to student errors and looking at like what, you know, students actually do, that you could ignore all of that, especially you have a program that doesn't have placement testing or anything like that. So you just have a lot of different students and there's no real script to follow, perhaps. It's just a general outline for the teacher. And so it would be hard, or if not impossible, to collect the rigorous data on student errors and student performance with these ill-conceived programs in the first place. So they're looking at the design, the look, they ask the teachers questions, which brings me to this question. Does the Engelmann-Becker sort of field testing approach collect data on what the teacher feels about the program, what the students say they enjoy about the program, or is that completely not the focus?
We do collect it. It's not as anything as systematic as what we do with what the events that occur in every field test classroom. And uniformly, and we get surprises sometimes about what they thought was their favorite passage or what they liked the most or what they didn't like. But oftentimes, that data is extremely unreliable. And, you know, there's in Clear Teaching by Shep Barbash, he talks about my dad citing, you know, blind people and how blind people could identify that there were walls there. And they had all sorts of ideas about how it worked. And when it was all said and done after experimenting, it was based on what they could hear. They needed to hear. They were actually getting, you know, a bounce back from the walls, and that's how they identified it. That is an extreme example, but it's like one of the reasons our field tests are so much better now than they used to be is now we've developed technological tools that didn't even exist when DI started that we can capture all of this data. And we used to have to rely on teachers after the lesson writing down what were problems. And that conflated problems because it would always be embedded in what they think would work as well as what the kids responded that was incorrect. And combining those two leads to fixes that may fix the issue but create other issues. And, you know, we really don't we don't have time to waste our energies on doing things not as well as we can the first time.
Absolutely. It makes me think like that this is such a extensive process. This is an expensive process. So there seems there'd be a perverse incentive to just not do it, right? You know what I mean? Like you could just take a program and you could maybe get a couple kids from the neighborhood and just check some things out, or you could just have teachers look it over, or just do it internally, deploy it. You save a lot of money. I guess that's not as much of a question. It's just something for people to be aware of, that there are not that many program approaches that within their concept of how we design and develop programs require or insist this field testing to the degree that DI does.
They don't know it's possible. The rhetoric, the beliefs in that are pervasive in the whole educational system is that the kids are the problem and you're not going to be able to reach kids. And if you can help most of them, oh, that's good enough. And, you know, if you can get these other kids, you know, and help them a little bit, then that's great. If they can live on their own. They don't know what's possible with kids, and they don't even have a clue where to start. I mean, the educational system has done a marvelous job of marginalizing direct instruction as a whole, and even further, marginalizing the development process and what we can actually achieve with these programs is even more obscured. So I got to give a lot of the educators a pass, but the reason we don't cut corners on this is because our mission is to stop the pain, stop the lost opportunity, stop this for the millions of kids that are failed every year. We, you know, that's, even if we're not able to do it, and I know that if we had the resources in 7 years, we could eradicate poor language skills, we could eradicate illiteracy, we could eradicate all of the math problems and kids hating math. It could all be eradicated in 7 years. But I'm not ridiculous enough to believe that I might even see that in my lifetime. But what my mission and what my goal, the right thing to do for me to produce these programs, so at least the tool is there. So if somebody can find it, they can do it and they can save those kids that they're working
with. Along with that mission, I try to communicate this. There's something about like the Nifty conference is coming up this summer. I invite people to come join me. I'll be there. Carl Hendrick's going to be there. Lots of people are going to be there. One of the things I notice is like what you just kind of mentioned, this sense of urgency in this process, this sort of mission-driven viewpoint of how to teach and how to design programs. One of the things that people always ask me is, how was it that Engelmann was able to know the science of learning before that word was really in our vernacular, before like all of these big buckets of cognitive load theory and retrieval practice have kind of come out? Here's what I think right now after listening to you on this. He figured this out by listening to the students and looking at what they did, rather than up in the layer of like of theory, even though there's a load of theory that underpins DI. Is there some truth to that?
There's not some truth to it. That's all true. I mean, his approach when he started working with kids is, if they didn't get the inference, if they didn't understand the information he was teaching, he looked at himself and said, they're behaving lawfully. I just don't understand what is making them behave that way. So I got to look at what I did to see what induced the wrong response. And that's where all of the direct instruction intellectual property evolves from. It all came from there because it's based on what happened, what the kids did, and what mistakes we made to induce those error patterns or the misinformation that they adopted and how to fix it. And again, there are a million details that are addressed in every lesson. Well, a million details in every lesson. And, you know, we adequately address all of the critical ones. So orchestrating all of those, the orchestration of each of these pieces, you know, you mentioned a bunch of different components of the programs and student facing and teacher facing and the scripts. All of those pieces have to be orchestrated in a way that's going to maximize, optimize the learning of the students. And it all is generated from the very foundational premise of, if a kid makes an error, that error was caused by something. Why did it do it?
It's fascinating to me. I thought maybe we could end in a fun way by talking a bit about like a story from the field that maybe might illustrate this. Maybe you came with a couple. It's great. I just think, but maybe what does this process produce? We'd love the kind of story that kind of captures what it feels like and when it's working, maybe even like what happens when the program's not working, what you did to address that. Over to you.
I have so many stories, field test stories of individuals and other things that it's very exciting to be able to, you know, I mean, it's like, what do I choose? But I want to talk about one of the field test teachers in, you know, that field test teacher that I had mentioned in that was teaching the corrective reading program. And she didn't even have basic DI skills. And Lynn House did such a marvelous job of, you know, working with her every week and having her get, you know, better at things. And all of the classic problems that you get from people who go through a traditional education program at a university were present. Instead of accepting reasonable responses, she would make kids go back in the passage and find the exact sentence that answers questions. She would force kids to answer questions in complete sentences, even though a lot of answers to questions aren't complete sentences. You know, just all of these classic, and of course, I already told you about the lack of correcting kids immediately. Well, it was very interesting because she was becoming a much better presenter, but the pacing of everything was just kind of grinding along. And part of that was because the kids had not realized that this is not mysterious stuff. The question we're asking you is something that you ought to be able to come up with very quickly. And the kids were starting to improve, but the lessons were still almost taking twice as long as they should have. And at this point, the teacher was presenting them adequately, and it was more a case of these kids. The kids were mostly getting them right, but it just was not flowing. And then one day we were listening to the recordings, and it flowed. And these kids were just performing marvelously, and they were starting to go through it. And then the teacher responded by next item. And it was just, this flow was happening. And we realized that this teacher had gone from being inadequate to being a pretty damn good teacher. But the kids had gone from being corrective readers, classic corrective readers, and they were now starting to become kids who were familiar and eager to engage in academics.
It's awesome. I'm looking forward to the new corrective reading revision that's coming out. Lots of people. I've seen the covers. I've seen the stuff. So I'm excited. I'm excited for it to come out. Owen, what is next for you then, as we close out this podcast episode?
Evan Haney mentioned earlier, and I are writing white papers about the corrective reading program. I'm excited about hopefully trying to get some of the people who are very familiar with teaching the 2008 version more familiar with it. We recognize that it's a different program. In the 2008 version, if you presented one word in a list, that's the way all of the words were presented. And in the field test data, we had three very experienced teachers who did different levels, and all of them had difficulty at least one time or another, either presenting all of the words the way the first word was implemented, and then they added too much stuff in, or they would look at the last word and present all the words, and then they missed a bunch of stuff. So we also have to talk about why, you know, many of these changes were made in the corrective reading program. And, some of it is vocabulary. I mentioned earlier that kids get limited by their fluency and prosody because of lack of understanding. And we were requested by McGraw-Hill to add more about definitions, and we installed pictures to show, to give them an actual view of what these things were. And of course, that not being in the 2008 version at all, the pictures come up, and now all of a sudden there's talk going on about the pictures, and then it sometimes stepped on the instruction and definitely, you know, added more time to the lesson. So there's a lot of pieces that are new, and we're very excited about it. And the performance of the kids is really outstanding. And this is coming from some of the users of the previous versions, and that means a lot. I mean, we have the data. We know that the kids are really getting it, but for the teachers to acknowledge that they're even getting it more than they did before is pretty powerful.
That is awesome. Right. Owen Engelman, thank you so much for coming on the DI podcast. Listeners, I would really appreciate it if you could spread this episode around and all the rest of the episodes. And if you've gotten to this point and you were extremely enthusiastic about what we've just talked about, I would suggest you go back. Some of the favorite episodes include the Project Follow-Through episode from which describes the single most extensive and expensive educational research project in the history of education. There's also a really excellent episode with Gene Stockard that I mentioned during this podcast, which talks about the evidence base behind DEI. Go check out all of the episodes. And otherwise, thank you so much, Owen. Take care.
Thank you.